This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio with a rebroadcast of an earlier program. Last year, the U.S. Department of Agriculture said that one out of every seven homes in the United States was food insecure. Here in North Carolina, that translates to more than 600,000 homes without regular access to nutritious food. And Black and Latino families, as well as families headed by single mothers, were 2.5 times more likely to be food insecure. Many organizers in the food movement ask themselves how we live in a world of such abundance while so many go unfed and malnourished. Maya Wiley is the founder and president of the Center for Social Inclusion. Pete Daniel also joins us on the program today. Pete is a historian and author of Dispossession, Discrimination Against African-American Farmers in the Age of Civil Rights. Welcome to both of you.
Good to be here, Frank.
Thank you.
Maya, when you explore the food system, you sort of break it down into three entities. Tell us about those.
We really look at food systems, and you know, the word system itself obviously indicates that there are many, many different actors within it. And we look at production, which is to say farms and farming. We look at processing and distribution, which is also about how we get it and who is working in it to get it to us. And then, of course, we look at us, meaning all of us who need food, which is all of us.
So those are the users. And when you look at that system, it's an amazing country. We produce a lot of food and more than we need based on, I think, 1 or 2% of the population that grows it. So there's enormous abundance, and yet it doesn't all seem to get where it should go.
Well, it's a really, really complicated and long story here, and I won't share it all. But one of the things to look at is that we've actually had different eras in food. So, you know, we had a period in our history where we were growing food largely to eat it and consume it locally and regionally. That obviously meant certain things about how we produced it, who produced it, how it was delivered. You know, we used to go to grocery store, not we, meaning not you and I, but certainly our grandparents would have gone to grocery stores where they weren't grocery stores. They were stores where you would go to a clerk and tell them that clerk what you wanted, and he or she would pull it off a shelf for you. But really what changed was both how we financed food, particularly in the 1930s post, you know, during the Depression, the fact that we had so many farmers that were starving themselves, not to mention people who were starving, and the way the government started to subsidize farmers actually to do exactly what you're referring to, which is to actually stop producing food in order to get the prices up. That actually started our kind of modern era of food, which was farm subsidy. Now, that's a long and complicated history, but one of the things that happened at the same time in the 1930s was the creation of the supermarket, which also changed how we as consumers bought food. And now we're entering a new era because through that process, we've really created a large, large multinational system of corporations that are not just controlling seed, they're controlling production, they're controlling distribution and processing, and they've made it largely an export market. So part of why we produce so much food is because we're producing it for export. So the irony is that we have people here in this country who don't get enough food while we produce more than we can possibly consume here.
And that has been going on for a long time. As you say, those changes have taken place over a few generations. But Pete, as you write in your book, Dispossession, you explore Black farmers' struggle for access to land. The idea that they would be producers has been a troubled history right from the start. Tell us about that.
Well, I want to agree with everything Maya said about the way the New Deal changed the whole face of American agriculture. And it mostly subsidized the more wealthy farmers. And in the process, those who weren't were dispossessed. And that was particularly true of African-American farmers. And just an example, in the 1960s alone in 10 southern states, the count of African-American farmers went from 132,000 to 16,000. That's an 88% decline. So those are people who could have been farming and having gardens and raising food and working outside the supermarket system, but they were gone. And I can explain that, but I don't want to monopolize.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about how that happened, because in the New Deal there were loans, there were subsidies, all kinds of things available to help farmers farm and also what ended up commodifying food. But this national program wasn't inherently racist. The trouble was, Pete, wasn't it that it was controlled and administered at the local level? And in the South, that meant that African-American farmers weren't going to get a new deal.
That's pretty much true. The Department of Agriculture was extremely discriminatory, both during the New Deal, and this is because it was local control pretty much, but at the same time, the federal government was not overseeing those local people and making sure they were not discriminating. So the different agencies that black farmers had to deal with, like the Farmers Home Administration, would not give them loans or would loan them more than they could pay back or wouldn't give them the loans they needed. And then the Agricultural Stabilization and Conservation Service, the ASCS, which gave acreage allotments, a lot of times did not award black farmers what they should have. And the Federal Extension Service, which was supposed to give farmers information and also work with 4-H clubs and so forth, they didn't give African-American farmers the same information they gave to white farmers or allow them to go to programs in some of the schools. So everywhere African-American farmers turned, they were getting less than equal rights.
So we can probably see this most clearly through the story of Timothy Pigford. Tell us about him.
Well, Timothy Pigford is really one of the most important civil rights activists of the 20th century and the 21st. And he came to light first when he testified before Congress in 1984 about his attempts to buy a farm. And he wanted to buy a farm in 1973. He found a farm for $47,000, but the federal FHA would not loan him the money, and so he couldn't farm. So meanwhile, he rented land and said in 1984 that if he had bought that farm, been allowed to buy that farm, the rent he'd paid meanwhile, he would have paid for the farm. But he had a very difficult time with the Farmers Home Administration. And indeed, by the time he testified in 1984 during the Reagan administration, the complaints from African-American farmers and all minority farmers, including women, Hispanics, and Indians, were just thrown away. They weren't even bothered with by the people in the Department of Agriculture.
And we should probably point out there was a civil rights office in the Department of Agriculture. They would examine complaints. And by 1980, the beginning of the Reagan administration, the number that were investigated, according to your book, was down to zero.
Yeah, they just didn't even bother with them. And even when they did bother in former administrations, this is not a Republican issue. It's a government issue. Even when they did investigate, a lot of times, if they found something, they wouldn't do anything about it.
Well, the problem goes back at least to the 1930s, and you can say really to Reconstruction, right? But the fact that the first really significant case, and this would be the Pigford case, doesn't come up until the 1980s and isn't resolved until the end of the 90s tells you something about the embedded nature of racism at the Agriculture Department.
Yeah, and if you talk to African American farmers today, they'll say, "Well, we got a settlement finally, but things haven't really changed."
Well, tell us about the settlement and kind of what it took to get that suit pressed and finished through the courts.
Well, Timothy Pigford brought the case, and it was decided in 1999. And Judge Friedman's words in there started off 40 acres and a mule, which resonated all the way through the history from the Civil War on up to when he gave that decision in 1999. And basically, Judge Friedman set up this elaborate system to find the people who were discriminated against. And that went on and on, and it was not until 2010 or 11 when Congress finally appropriated the money for the black farmers, and I think in some cases that's still held up in litigation. So it's just been one of these nightmares for black farmers. And, of course, the Pigford case only went back to 1981, at the beginning of the Reagan administration. It didn't deal with the people that I'm writing about earlier.
Well, Maya, tell us how that affects the discrimination against African-American farmers and Latinos and women. How does that affect that big food chain that you were talking about?
It's significant because having land and being able to produce food is obviously at the center of food access and healthy food. And one of the things that's important to note about what Pete is really talking about, he's talking about the farmers more likely to grow fruits and vegetables. Half of all Native American farmers, half of all Black farmers, two out of three of Asian farmers and Hawaiian farmers grow fruits and vegetables. These are the healthy foods we all need to eat more of. When we talk about food deserts, communities that do not have sufficient access to food, usually don't have supermarkets, don't have access to healthy produce, it's usually in part because they don't have the producers who are delivering the product to them, let alone whether they can afford for the food. And one of the things to go back here that's so important, what Pete is talking about, and you asked a very important question, Frank, about discrimination. One of the things to understand about how a race-neutral policy like Farm Bill, you know, which unfortunately we're going to be talking more about soon, Farm Bill operates race-neutrally, but because of a long history of depriving people of color from large parcels of land, it means that those people are less able to compete in the commodities that are actually subsidized by the government through things like the Farm Bill. And fruits and vegetables are not subsidized.
Because those farmers are already in the business, they can take advantage of it, and now there's a huge barrier to entry. And we're going to talk more about that as our conversation continues. I want to say thank you to Pete Daniel, historian and author of Dispossession, Discrimination Against African-American Farmers in the Age of Civil Rights. Pete, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Our conversation will continue with Maya Wiley, the founder and president of the Center for Social Inclusion, and more on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking with Maya Wiley about the movement surrounding different parts of our food system and food justice. She's the founder and president of the Center for Social Inclusion. So really what we're talking about, Maya, is the commodification of food. You talked about the people who are being discriminated against were growing fruits and vegetables, a little harder to commodify than the corn and soybean that we see now that's turned into other products and sent around, also that we invest on the commodity futures trading market and that sort of thing. So how is that evolving, and how does that affect the food chain itself, the fact that we have commodified food, that we treat it now as an investment and not as nourishment?
One of the things that we have to realize about our current food system is that literally 83% of the market is controlled by a very small number of stateless corporations. And I emphasize stateless because it's not, you know, we're not anti-corporate. I mean, there's a role for corporations in the food system. There's no question about that. The question is about the balance and the monopolization and the control. And when you have a few large mega companies owning 83% of the market, and by the way, they're what we call vertically integrated. That means they're not just controlling the seed and saying who owns it. They're actually controlling then the delivery of that seed, not just for producing food like corn and soy, but also for feeding cattle, for feeding hogs. Who they own the companies that package and process the food. Then they own part of the food that's actually sold on shelves, the processed food that's sold, as well as the exports. So what happens is they actually control the whole food economy. No one or small handful of anybody should control the whole food economy because it usually distorts it. And that's that commodification is what you're talking about is really what we're seeing happening, so that the small mom and pop farmers, the family farmers of all races, are finding themselves increasingly unable to compete. And so as a result, it's obviously farmers of color have dropped rapid numbers much, much faster. I think in North Carolina, you're down to 1,500 Black farmers. In 1987, you had over 3,000. So that precipitous drop continues. But that's also obviously true of white farmers who are her family farmers. And that reduces these kinds of products that we need to be able to get access to in our communities and their ability to make a viable living, which is also what keeps our rural communities able to be sustainable and intact. That's something we have to pay a lot of attention to, I think, in this country.
And even farms that would appear to be small farms or smaller farms, because of the way this economy has been restructured and the commodification of food, many of these farmers are working under contract to a
That's
large,
right.
and they have very very little say over, I mean, over the production, what they produce, what
whether
they feed.
Whether they can produce organically. One of the things that happens is if a farmer wants to pull out of a contract, they can't afford to pull out of the contract. They can't afford the cost of pulling out. So even if they're willing to try growing organically, growing produce and being part of a CSA, you know, a farm-to-table program, it's incredibly difficult for them to figure out a way to make that shift. They're sort of owned by these contracts that they're in, which at one point, you know, appeared to be – it was a logical business decision to stay afloat as a family farm. The other thing just to note about race in this equation is that the size of the plot of land you own has a lot to do with whether you're able to be viable in this market economy because corporations have taken it to such a large scale. Well, you know, the average black farmer owns 100 acres and the average white farmer owns 400. So, you know, and half of all black farmers own 50 acres or less. So what that means is you actually can't really compete.
It's interesting because if you talk about a market economy, you want competition. And yet everything in our structure, including the Farm Bill, and we're going to get to that in a minute, really militates against that and becomes an obstacle to competition. And you sort of wonder if in other words, we're proud of the fact that we're down to 1% of our population producing our food. That's a sign of you know, improvement and a developed economy. A developed economy boasts fewer farmers. And yet it seems to me that what you're saying is we need to bring more farmers into this system.
We need to bring more farmers into the system that are farming smaller and producing to a local or regional food hub. You know, the shorter the distance the food travels, the better it is for you because the more nutrients it has. It's also the better it is for the environment because the smaller your carbon footprint and the more likely that the communities themselves are going to get access to the food, right? You're going to find it just makes sense. And it's a way for us to make sure our communities are sustainable economically as well as in terms of the physical health of the community. So I think it's something that I'm not nostalgic. I believe in progress. There's a way to do this in a 21st century context. We're not trying, believe me, I as a black woman do not want to go back to the 1930s. But I think that there's something that we have to learn about how we're going to keep ourselves healthy and well-fed and keep our communities viable. In this time.
It seems to me that here in North Carolina, particularly in this region in the Triangle, people have gotten it. There's an upsurge now in sustainable farming, local farming, eating local. Everybody gets it. Here's the catch. It's a lot more expensive than conventional farming. So for poor families, it's not even an option.
It's also more expensive if you don't have a lot of land. You have to command more for what you're producing. So even if you're not growing organically or growing in sustainable ways, it's more effective if you're it's expensive if you're a small producer. You know, this is one of the greatest ironies of our system. Part of how we got to a mega export food system that we have today is because large corporations' interest was in driving prices down. Because if they could drive the price of food low enough, they could expand to a global market, to people who couldn't pay as much. But it also meant they could drive labor costs down because it was cheaper to buy the food than they could argue for paying people less. So now what we have is stagnant wages. So we have people who need healthy food the most, least able to afford it. While we have some of the lowest food prices, we actually have to get wages up so people can pay what who can pay the small producers and can buy healthy food. And that's the irony. A smaller food economy actually would help support that more than this large mega food economy.
So with an 8%, 9% unemployment rate, the idea of putting people back to work and paying them a decent wage might make a little bit of sense.
Yep.
And also part of the technology certainly has helped in bringing food prices down. There are economies of scale that can be realized. And subsidies, 64 cents out of every dollar that an industrial farmer earns, I think the last time I looked, comes from a government, state, federal, or local.
That's right.
So it's not all just efficiencies in the system, the economic system. Well, there are a lot of people in North Carolina, as I say, who are working on agricultural education, and especially with young people. Charlotte Ammons works in Goldsboro, North Carolina. She coordinates a program called SWARM, Students Working for an Agricultural Revolutionary Movement, another program called Produce Peddlers. Charlotte Ammons is a community-based food systems outreach coordinator at the Center for Environmental Farming Systems and on our program now. Hi, Charlotte.
Hello, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a bit about Goldsboro. I guess the food production in North Carolina, in eastern North Carolina, in particularly, mm-hmm. that's the farm belt for North Carolina, right?
Right, I would agree. Goldsboro is like a lot of small towns, especially in eastern North Carolina. We're the fifth largest agricultural county in the state. We're technically urban just because of the density of the population in the center part of the city, but very culturally rural. Most people who grew up who are currently in Goldsboro either grew up on family farms or either transplants from, you know, more rural areas than Goldsboro into the city. And a lot of military folks and elders who decided to stay after their military stint. So I don't think Goldsboro looks unlike a lot of eastern North Carolina towns in that respect.
Tell us about Swarm.
Swarm is a group of young people, mostly high school age kids, and they work on food issues that are very specific and relevant to them, mostly things that are happening within their schools. So one of their first campaigns was around just getting a salad bar into their high school cafeteria. So basically it's training them up to consider themselves stakeholders and to amplify their own voices to actually move policy, however that looks, that affects them directly.
Yeah, they also got involved in ending pink slime.
Yes, it was all over the news, and it just kind of hit their gut. Like, and then they actually just made the move to have a conversation with their school nutrition director. You know, and they did their research on what it really is and how it affects their bodies.
Tell us what it is, just in case
really
a news blackout.
It's a meat filler, and it actually looks like pink gum. It's used a lot just in meat products. So they were very interested in making sure that it was not used in their school food. And it really just basically took a call to their school nutrition director and a conversation. And she recognized that they worked really hard and did their research, and she responded by saying, you know, I can guarantee that. For you.
What does it do to the prices? Well, I mean, these are fixed costs, the amount of money a state is going to spend or a locality on school lunches, right?
Right. And I think that's a part of the struggle, I guess, is, you know, we work to get more local food in schools. But like you were saying earlier, the price point is always an issue. So you know, it's a barrier to not just the students that consume the foods, but also to the farmers, because this could be a really great potential market for them. So that's something that we really have to work on.
I'm guessing, Maya, that some of the sources for this pink slime could have come from farm lots, feed lots somewhere in the Plains states. Maybe started with piglets here in North Carolina that went by train out there. They got fed there and sent back here. And for some reason, that's cheaper than growing food just outside of Greenville and taking it to schools in other parts of eastern North Carolina, huh?
Well, it's like you said earlier, Frank, it's economies of scale. It's not really cheaper, but if you're big enough, you can make it cheaper. Okay. But it's not really a healthy, good, strong economy. So lots of bizarre things that we all don't really want to eat, you know, we end up eating, and we end up eating it cheaper.
Well, what do you do about that? I mean, it is a paradox. Here's all this good food that grows all around you. It's under your feet, and you can't afford it, and you'd rather and people are paying for it. They're not paying for it at the checkout line. They're paying in their tax bill because, as I said, more than half of the money comes from somewhere else. So Charlotte is raising consciousness. These kids are now much more aware of what goes into their bodies and where it comes from and what's good for them. What do you do sort of at the policy level to change that? It sounds like you have to shift an entire economy for that to be changed.
You know, one of the things that's so amazing about policy when you're wonky like me and look at the policy history is you realize that we make huge structural shifts in this country all the time, and we make it through making decisions through policy. So what seems impossible and unimaginable is sometimes as simple as a stroke of the pen. So we create – I don't mean it's simple to get that pen stroke, but certainly it's – the point is if you can win the policy, you can actually change the economy is not natural. We created it through policy. So when we said – when we said back in the 30s through the early 40s, we're going to actually make the crop of choice corn, soy, and wheat, and we're going to pay for it. We the taxpayer, through government programs, are going to pay for it. You know, what we did is created an expansion of those crops, and then corporations said, we want to get them out internationally. We want to actually export them. We actually import more fruits and vegetables than we export, right? So it's not that we couldn't. The fact that we say we won't subsidize fruits and vegetables, but we will subsidize corn, soy, wheat, and corn and soy are the biggest, $49 billion a year in subsidies. So I'm not suggesting we shouldn't support corn and soy and wheat. I'm saying we should put it in balance and support fruits and vegetables. If we literally created subsidies for fruits and vegetables, number one, it would be fairer because we'd be taking care of a lot of farmers of color in this country who are much more likely to be producing them and on much smaller plots of land. Mm-hmm. It's also produce that we need that we need in our communities, and we're much more likely to find local markets for. So when you start to talk about, you know, school, you know, farm to school programs, it's fruits and vegetables are largely what you need most to get into those schools. You know this, Frank, but we have lost all connection with where our food comes from. Mm-hmm. And if you recall the Food Revolution documentary, which showed that first graders in rural West Virginia did not know what a tomato was. But a policy shift that invests in fruits and vegetables would change that. Mm-hmm.
Subsidizing Lunchables that grow in the wild, in the mountains of West Virginia. Well, Charlotte, what happens with your kids? I mean, your students, so they become a little bit aware of what's going on at their lunch table. Do you scale it up? Does it become policy questions for them? I mean, how do they respond once they are aware?
I think they relate to it in their maybe this is a teenager kind of thing, but the ways that are most immediate to them. So instituting a policy, if you will, in their school that says, you know, not just my school, but none of the schools in my county will have pink slime, or, you know, that you can start with a salad bar in my school, but I have the expectation that all schools in my county will have a salad bar as an option for all the students. I think that's how they start to get exposed to how policy can move, or how change is effective, not just for them, but to their entire communities.
There was a great piece in this week's New York Times magazine supplement about the fast food industry and the snack food industry, and how much money they spend and time making foods essentially worthless and harmful, right? But there's a lot of money and a lot of research that goes into it.
Right.
The argument of among those CEOs, when you say, hey, what are you doing to us? They say, well, it's the market. This is what kids want. It's what people want, Lunchables. Forget that there's all that fat and carbohydrate in there. That's what they want, and we're in business to feed the market. Now, you're telling me kids are asking for a salad bar.
I'm telling you that.
So it's
the truth. Yeah, I think it's a myth. I think, you know, like, I think it's ultimately about limiting, I guess, intellectual freedom. When you limit people's choices as to what is available to them, of course it seems like, you know, that this is their thing, you know. So, but when you open up the possibilities to young people, and, you know, they can identify more options, then it becomes more clear that they are very receptive to those options. And I think that's the myth that exists in a lot of marginalized communities. You know, the myth that poor people don't want to eat, or poor people eat less healthy, I mean, just because they don't want healthier foods. You know, it's really more of a question of access to information and education around these foods, access to, you know, good jobs and the availability to be able to afford these foods. So, you know, I think it's really about opening up the windows of possibility.
One of the ways those possibilities are limited are with our food distribution system at the retail level. Supermarkets create food deserts. Tell us about that, Maya.
You know, what's interesting about supermarkets, in addition to the fact that they're really a creation of the middle of the 20th century, you know, they're fairly new. Mm-hmm. One of the things that supermarkets did as a business model was to say, we're going to decide where to locate based on the median household income of the community. So we're going to decide that people can afford us based on median household income. So low-income communities, which are also often communities of color, as well as some white communities, white rural communities and white urban communities, they don't look so attractive if that's the metric that you're using. But the reality is, if you looked at purchasing power, which is a different way of looking at it, because most people are going to buy food. They're going to buy food. They may not have a lot of money, but food is going to be purchased.
Right.
If you look at purchasing power, it's a totally different equation in seeing who can afford the store, the supermarket. So what happened was supermarkets essentially were excluding large numbers of communities from their business model, when a mere shift in how they thought about their business model would have opened up that opportunity to locate. Supermarkets, because of economies of scale, as we were talking earlier, are much more likely to have fruits and vegetables, as well as all the packaged and processed foods. Mm-hmm. But it gives people a much bigger range of choice and also much more affordably. You know, the other thing about supermarkets is supermarkets actually, because we don't want to just bash them, right? I mean, part of why we have food deserts is we need more supermarkets as one of the options. But supermarkets were also unionized labor.
Mm-hmm.
And supermarkets often hired people from the communities that they were located in. So it also denied, you know, low-income communities jobs and unionized jobs not to locate there. But one of the things that's happening now is supermarkets are now in trouble. As food has now gone into pharmacies, food has gone into big box stores. I mean, we're actually seeing the retail food economy going through a new era where supermarkets are starting to look like the dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. And we now have the Walmarts of the world, as well as the Duane Reades and other supermarket chains, Walgreens, now selling food, but not necessarily good and healthy food.
Yeah.
On the State of Things today, Maya Wiley, founder and director of the Center for Social Inclusion, Charlotte Ammons, community-based foods outreach coordinator at the Center for Environmental Farming, and we will talk more about our food chain on the State of Things when our conversation continues. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. Today, exploring the many facets of our food system, Maya Wiley is the founder and director of the Center for Social Inclusion. Charlotte Ammons is the community-based foods outreach coordinator at the Center for Environmental Farming Systems. And right now, Emily Chavez joins us. She is the founder of Durham's Co-op Bread Uprising. Emily, welcome to the program. Good
Thank
to have you.
You
here.
Thank you. Good to be
and
here.
I guess before we go any farther, Maya, we got one of our facts wrong by a factor of 10 or something.
Facts are important. And I just, to be fair to the subsidy programs that we've been talking about, I think I said $49 billion a year goes to corn and soy, and what I meant was $4.9 billion. It's still a huge amount, but obviously not $49.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we'll talk more about that and how they're arranged. But Charlotte, we talked about one of the programs, Swarm, that mm-hmm. you've helped organize. Another one is called Produce Peddlers. Tell us about that.
Well, we do center young people in much of our work down in Goldsboro. And what we're doing with our Produce Peddler program is that we're employing mostly young people of color to work with local farmers, mostly under-resourced farmers of color, starting at our farmers market to deliver produce into low-income areas. And part of that program, another piece of that program, hopefully that will happen this spring, is that we'll have a mobile EBT machine where folks in these communities can actually swipe on site, if you will, and they can use their EBT benefits or their SNAP benefits to purchase locally grown produce.
Is the produce, I mean, when I think of farmers market, I think of something with a slightly higher price point mm-hmm. because of the way it's grown and all the things we've been talking about. So is it more expensive, and how does that work when they get peddled into these communities?
It is slightly more expensive, but we also hope, though, to do, I mean, in everything we do, we try to move an education campaign with that. But, I mean, a lot of farmers don't necessarily, at least what we found, is don't necessarily see the benefit of using EBT at the market. But that is something that is that makes their produce a lot more accessible to the communities that we try to reach. So we're hoping in the end that it'll you know, create that, at least go towards creating that sense of balance.
Emily, tell us about Bread Uprising.
So Bread Uprising is a cooperative community bakery here in Durham. I'm actually a founding member, but a part of a bigger community that works together to provide about 40 families in Durham and the surrounding areas with bread each week, bread and some other bread-related items. We have about 4 bakers right now. It is in operation out of one of the founding bakers' homes, Noah, and the sort of vision of our bakery is to really to build community and at the same time provide people with something as basic as bread each week using an alternative model of exchange. So people pay or contribute to the bakery in different ways, and it's not all monetary. People do pay what they can as far as money goes, but we also we all participate in for instance cleaning up and delivering bread, and all of us are responsible for doing some part of that, and there are other ways that people kind of contribute to the bakery as well, but those are
so who receives the bread, how do they find out about you, and how diverse is this group in terms of income and race and all of that?
So right now, like I said, it's about 40 families. It started out about 4 years ago at about 25 families, and these, you know, these folks have come to us, or we've gathered in different ways. Noah and Tim are the sort of founding visionaries of the bakery, and they were longtime friends of mine and my partner, and so we found out about it that way, And then we, you know, did sort of outreach in different ways. We tried talking to different specific organizations who might serve, folks of color and poor people or people who might have a hard time accessing regular food. And we also did word of mouth campaigns, literally going door to door. Just advertised, you know, via sort of regular methods of email and all that, but we also try to be creative and try to reach out to folks. And we are, we do have a radical majority of color in the bakery. So 60% of the bakery is always people of color. And we also aim to serve poor families and queer families and families in general, folks with kids.
Maya, it sounds like what we're talking about here is an alternative structure. This is looking at food as nutrition, not as a commodity. We don't want investors to we need for farmers and producers to make money, but not investors. And that's a huge difference, the big difference, it seems to me, in the production. But is that what it takes? Are we talking about creating alternative structures in order to change this food chain?
I think it's a both and. So, for instance, there actually are examples of investors in alternative forms of producing food. It's not that having investors is the bad thing. It's what you're trying to create through your investment. So, for instance, in the South Bronx of New York City, which is a very low-income community of color, there's also a bakery, the Grayston Bakery, which is actually employing people with felony records who can't get jobs doing anything else. And it's a cooperative bakery where the workers also have a part of an ownership stake as well. Mm-hmm. But there are investors in that. And one of the conversations I know that's going on is, how do you take that to scale? Yeah. So I think it's that there are multiple models. And one of the things that we really want to see is diversity in the economy. Mm-hmm. So we're not anti-corporate. We think there's a role for corporations. We think there's a role for big corporations. We think there has to be room for all these other kinds of innovation to also be in our economy. Some of that's going to have an investment structure. Some of that's going to have a cooperative model. Some of that's going to be, you know, we shouldn't actually see it as limited. We mm-hmm. should see it actually as thinking, let's let 1,000 flowers bloom. Let's figure out a whole bunch of different kinds of innovation we can see that's because I also think that one of the things we have to think about is what works where. I don't think it's going to be a one size fit all. I think on native communities, you know, on tribal lands are going to need to do it differently from New York City communities, are maybe going to need to do it differently from North Carolinian communities. So, and I think what we want to do is have innovation that works in our context as well as for our overall economy.
Absolutely. And I think what we're seeing also in Goldsboro is that the alternative models is what what is getting our young people re-engaged in a different and more energetic kind of way. They're seeing their that end of the social investment as well, because we know that a lot of Black and Latino youth are often left out of these conversations about their own bodies and their own well-being. We work with a lot of young people, mostly currently actually young Black men who are raising their own families, with in really poor situations, and they are really conscious about their food choices, and they're really concerned about methods of how is this food question not just about food, but is also about a larger movement towards an agenda towards economic justice, because this matters to them, completely.
And the potential for a particularly depressed place like Eastern North Carolina to build whole industries, because you're not only talking about farming, there's processing involved.
Absolutely.
And then retailing. I mean, all of that is a lot of jobs, a lot of industry, a bigger tax base, right? If you build a place that processes meat and processes vegetables, that place is now on the tax rolls.
Exactly.
Are kids interested, that your students interested in getting into farming?
We're seeing a resurgence of it, actually. It's been really interesting. And I think what's been key to that is allowing them the opportunity to work with a lot of elders in the community. We don't want to exclude that. There's a lot of resiliency that's been built because of that. And, we are very intentional about linking elders and young people. And it's been really a really compelling thing to see, that exchange of learning and that exchange of innovation, because Maya talked about earlier the 21st, like looking at things from a 21st century perspective, and that's what these young folks bring, particularly to the aging farmers. Our average age of farmers in North Carolina is pushing like right around 60 years old, and that's it's even higher for Black and Latino farmers. So there are ways that we're finding to bridge that gap.
Yeah, you can't tweet a carrot. Pictures of carrots, but not a carrot. So then you have to learn. And Maya, that is one of the problems. So many farmers have gone out of the system, Black and white, but that the memory, the collective memory of this is being lost, isn't it?
It's so fascinating to me. My own personal story is that my mother grew up in West Texas. And while I grew up, very much a child of the city, of northeastern cities, I had a lot of connection to at least understanding food from her stories. She would talk about clabber and how that was the best thing on earth was clabber. And I was like, what the heck is clabber?
Wait, what is clabber?
Well, it's the fatty part of fresh milk when it hasn't been pasteurized. Okay. That if you live in a place with a dairy cow, you get to eat the fat.
Uh-huh.
Well, I don't know how that good is from a health perspective, but from her perspective, it was like the best thing.
If you had to walk a mile and a half to milk the cow and come back, it would be okay.
Yeah,
that's
right.
The problem.
Yeah,
but
right.
Tweeting,
or maybe run a mile and a half to milk the cow.
If all you're doing is tweeting carrots to your friends,
but I guess
not so good.
The point is, there's very, and my mother tore up. I'll never forget. We live in the middle of the city, but she tore up because she came from a farming community and from a farming history. So she tore up our driveway because we didn't need a driveway. You could park on the street. And she planted stuff in our, and I remember I had to go out there and get the tomatoes and the garlic and the zucchini, from the driveway to make the summer salads. And so my whole point is, that was a cultural connection to food, that even though I was going into a supermarket to buy the food, I understood where the food came from.
Right.
And I understood it in a practical sense. One of the things that we are seeing, which I think is really exciting and is happening without the support that it should have, is a resurgence of urban gardening, and people actually looking for ways, including, by the way, very low income people in New York City. We're seeing people in housing projects, all kind, very low income communities looking for ways to garden, mm-hmm. to get that produce they have no place to buy,
yeah.
And I think that there's something very hopeful in that. But when we don't have that, and Charlotte was talking about these farm to school programs, one of the things that research shows is it actually reestablishes that connection, so that mm-hmm. when kids are seeing in those programs, they are actually making different choices about what to eat. There are obviously much healthier choices. One of the ways that we need to think about this, it's such a structural issue for this country, both in terms of the environment and carbon emissions, as I've said. You know, the climate is changing. I'm with President Obama. If you don't want to believe the science, I don't know what to say to you. It's clear. And food is part of that carbon footprint, and producing it locally and consuming it locally is going to be really good to deal with climate change. But the other thing is it helps kids actually participate differently, see the food system differently. They make different choices. So how people get food changes how they understand food.
Absolutely.
And Emily, I know Bread Uprising does workshops, right? So is this the kind of thing you talk about there? I mean, what goes on in those workshops?
We have assemblies about twice a year, and we talk about all kinds of issues that come up around this. One of the principal sort of elements to the bakery is this idea that communities already have an abundance of resources that we can draw on, which is not to take away from the many ways in which our communities are under-resourced, but at the same time, you know, like you were saying, Maya, we can use what we have. And so and I think it's so important that we teach our children this too, that you know, you may grow up and see that other people have this or that thing that you may not have access to right now, but you can provide for yourself in a lot of ways, and we can take care of each other. So we have exchanges where people do grow things in their backyard that ends up in the bread that gets delivered and that kind of thing. And we talked about that, and we talked about sort of breaking down what does it really mean to eat healthy? What does that really mean? A lot of different things over the years.
The Farm Bill is coming up for consideration again. There are a lot of interests in there and a lot of money that goes into lobbying for those subsidies and to keep them going, Maya. I know that you talked about the hope that this is all going to change. Do you see enough movement at the grassroots level to move the politics, as I say, the money behind maintaining these subsidies and the current structure? Pretty powerful. Where are we now politically?
You know, you're absolutely right. And where we are politically is in a very bad place. I won't lie. What we're seeing, and, you know, with these fiscal cliff conversations, the sequester back at the front of the news cycle again, as we're looking at Friday as the deadline before we start to see agencies have to figure out how to make very draconian cuts. One of the things that we're hearing out of Washington is, maybe as a strategy, we'll tie Farm Bill, not all Farm Bill, we'll just pull the subsidy conversation, but using the Farm Bill as a bargaining chip, but only pieces of the Farm Bill. The problem with that is using it as a bargaining chip is going to make bad Farm Bill policy. Because it's really about a bargaining chip about how we cut things that we vitally need. And a lot of those programs that we're talking about, we're in such bad shape that we actually did have some programs that are important to some of what we've been talking about today in the existing Farm Bill, like a program that supports socially disadvantaged farmers and helps get them resources. I mean, that's $25 million a year is not a lot of money, but we're not talking about farmers with a lot of money. Mm. That got cut out of the deal. Mm. Trying to get it restored is very difficult against some of the interests that we're talking about. But if we start carving up what we're talking about politically, it makes it very difficult to fight for these very, very important but from a size perspective, very small programs. Part of what we need to do is actually think holistically about Farm Bill and holistically about what kind of food system we're trying to produce. I think one of the hopes that I have isn't for this particular Farm Bill, let's be honest. It's about how we take the kinds of things that Charlotte and Emily are talking about and how we aggregate a demand for something different from all these wonderful little green shoots that we see sprouting up without much support outside of people's own ingenuity, ability to come together and make something happen, to actually start demanding something different. Linking it all up, I think, would create, you know, what Foucault would call diffuse power.
Once we get to critical mass, it'll link itself. That's our greatest hope. And I want to thank all of you for being on the program today.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that was a rebroadcast of a show taped earlier this year. It featured Shorelette Ammons, the community-based foods outreach coordinator at the Center for Environmental Farming Systems. Emily Chavez is one of the founders of Durham's co-op Bread Uprising. And Maya Wiley is the founder and director of the Center for Social Inclusion. Thanks for listening. If you want more information, our website is stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Nicole Campbell, Alex Granados, Laura Lee, and Sean Nguyen. Robin Copley is the technical director. Brent Wolf, the news director. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.